This is the second of a two-part episode about opposition to Zionism in Israel. So if you haven't heard part one, I'd go back and listen to that first.
In this episode, we focus on the group's activity after the 1967 war, talking again with founder Moshe Machover, as well as two other members who formed the next generation of anti-Zionist activists in Israel.
This is Working Class History.
The following year was 1968, which marked a whole upsurge of left-wing and student radical movements everywhere. And we, as it were, became part of it. Of course, concerned with local issues, but this was part of it. So people who were sort of inspired by what was happening, let's say, in France or in Britain or in America at the time, sort of found Matzpen as the corresponding thing.
So the focus of 1968 in Israel?
Well, that was, the situation vis-a-vis the Palestinians, the occupation and so on. So, you see, 1968 was, I was starting to say, it always puzzles me as waves of radicalization or the opposite are worldwide, but at the same time triggered apparently in each place by local issues. You see, so in France, what triggered it was, a certain chain of events among students in Paris, and then it spread. In America, it was the Vietnam War. In Israel, there was this local issue, but there is a certain, somehow, as it were, behind the scenes or behind our backs, there is some sort of international connections that are working, or a certain atmosphere or mood. So Matzpen grew in public awareness of it because it sort of flowed into the radicalization of young people.
Two young people who got involved later in the organization's history were Udi Sivush and Chaim Skortayu, two Matzpen activists in Haifa. Here they talk about how they first came into contact with the group.
Growing up in Israel, I mean, people are sort of politically aware, not necessarily activists, but obviously, and after the 67 war, I mean, all this issue of the occupied territories and this and that, I was very much in the news all the time. You couldn't really escape it. I was not an activist as a school kid, but politically aware, yes, and thinking about the issue. And gradually, throughout that same, after in 67, I was only 12 years old. And I must say that at the time, hearing the official position of the then government, which was the Israeli Labour Party of the time, and the opposition, which is the right-wing Likud, who were for the greater Israel, the latter sounded more reasonable to me because essentially they were both saying the same: you can't trust the Arabs, they only understand force. But some would say, oh, well, we can get some arrangement with some, not obviously with Palestinians, but with some Hashemite regime or the other. And they say, no, it's ours and we take it, yeah? So I thought that sounded quite reasonable to me. Gradually, I mean, just reading newspapers, and I must say I was helped by some Israeli ex-generals who were writing sort of opinion columns in Israeli newspapers. And then they sort of demolished really the notion that holding those so-called, post-67 occupied territories was a security issue, i.e. that Israel could not defend itself or survive without this territory. And these were some really generals, ex-generals. And little by little, I got converted to the idea that, in fact, no, there's no need to have, to stick to these occupied territories. And then, I suppose, by the age of, 16 or thereabout, I was on the very edge of Zionism in the sense that I did not really see it as Zionism being some sort of imperialist sort of movement, colonialism, and that was wrong to start with and all that. But I did actually become convinced of the two, what nowadays is called the two-state solution. Only that at the time, that was considered very, very extreme, because the official position of Israel was that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't even talk about national rights, yeah?
Yeah.
I was not an anti-Zionist at 18 when I was conscripted to the army. This is why I was not a conscientious objector or anything like mm-hmm. that. And I was recruited to the military sort of intelligence. Not James Bondish. It's more like in the UK would be the equivalent of GCHQ, let's say.
Okay.
But in Israel, it's part of the military. And there I became, I think, gradually more radicalized. What sort of knowing things and hearing things, and there was already trouble in the south of Lebanon, and although I personally in my military work had nothing to do with the Palestinian issue or anything like that, I was in fact working vis-a-vis the Syrian army,
mm-hmm.
but I felt very pissed off about what was happening, plus what was happening, you know, in the occupation of territories, and I didn't keep my mouth shut, and I got into some clashes with some one or two officers there,
mm-hmm.
and I ended up being kicked out for obviously security reasons, from a military, unfortunately, but from the intelligence.
Mm.
Actually, Mats Penn, I must say, we were, and I'm sure Udi as well, we were all already as kids, although it was a tiny, tiny organization. Mm. Everybody in Israel at the time was aware of their existence, yeah? We were, I mean, as school kids, we had no direct contact with Mats Penn, but we were aware they existed.
Mm.
They carried some sort of ideological weight, really.
Mm. So, you heard about them from, there were people in your school?
I had some school who was in a Trotsky youth organization called Hafer, the Mall, and I knew them there in the school.
Right.
I knew about them, and my friends from school attacked them one day. We had a visit of Ezer Weitzman, who was, he later became the president of the, but at the time he was before he was the head of the commander of the Air Force.
Mm.
And he visited in our school and to have the a speech to all the students, and they made some demonstration inside the hall, these kids.
Mm-hmm.
They were a year below us.
How many kids were there?
Three.
Yeah.
And so everybody attacked them, and I actually kind of said, leave them alone. For me, the issue of the occupied territories and the Palestinian and the Israelis, for me, it looked like the only solution. I mean, not instinctively, not theoretically, that just can live together in one place.
Mm.
And I later met an activist of Mats Penn called Arye. He came to where I was in the army at the time, just before the election of 73, and we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when I met him again in Haifa, we talked about more seriously and more deeply, and then I joined the organization.
In my case, my transition to, as I've already mentioned, I was sort of, let's say, on the edge, on the far edge of Zionism, but the transition actually was a pure ideological and not for nationalistic reasons, or national reasons rather for because of class issues, i.e., once, and during this military service, or towards the end, and a bit later then, I started sort of reading socialist writing and Marx and all that. And I became convinced that being a socialist and being a Zionist don't tally. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you had to choose one or the other, and I chose socialism rather than Zionism. In personal terms, because Udi and I, you know, had been very close friends already from school and all that, and he started, you know, getting involved with Matt Spen in 75, you said, yeah?
Yeah.
And so about a year later, I started, you know, in 76.
By the time that Chaim and Udi were breaking with Zionism and getting involved with Matt Spen, Moshi had already moved to London, where he encountered a political culture radically different from the one he had left behind in Israel.
It couldn't be more different. I mean, like, remember, when I came here, it was 1968. Yeah? Was, you know, the atmosphere here was, I mean, you haven't experienced things like that in your lifetime. It was, I mean, it was a big radical shift in public opinion, especially among young people. And we, you know, we found ourselves in a sort of very sympathetic milieu. We made immediate contacts with people on the left, and you know, we helped them to educate, you know, their milieu on the situation in the Middle East.
And what sort of differences did you notice between, you know, between the sort of the state of maybe the left and the workers' movement in Britain, you know, in the late 60s, compared with what you just left behind in...
Well, I mean, it was a different world. I mean, remember, Britain was beginning to sort of recover from the hangover of empire. So this was, you know, sort of a period of recovery, trying to, as it were, come to terms. The atmosphere here in the rest of Europe couldn't be more different than in Israel. I mean, in Israel, the left, radical left, was a very small minority. Here, it was a minority in Europe, but a big and very influential and very much evident in public opinion. We found ourselves in very high demand, you see, because until 1967, a big part of the left here, almost the whole of the left here, with, you know, very, you know, tiny exceptions, were very sympathetic to Israel. But we also, you know, went up and down the country and spoke at meetings. In socialist societies, in universities, at the time, we're talking about the early 70s now, late 60s, early 70s, there was very active student life politically, and in each university had a socialist society which brought together people from different, you know, socialist currents.
And was there ever any response from, you know, from Zionist students? Were there any Zionist student societies?
There were a few, yes, but I mean, they were not as organized and as sort of vicious and as trained to attack us for anti-Semitism. You know, that now they are prompted whenever you say anything, you know, critical of Israel, that's anti-Semitic. But they, you see, we were well informed, and our opponents were not well informed. And when Israel sent people to make propaganda for the Israeli line in various European countries, we came to their meetings and gave our line, you know, in questions and so on. We demolished them. They said, you know, that you know, they had no weapons against us. I mean, no, they couldn't counter, because we knew what we were talking about and we could very easily refute their positions. Look, the difference was at that time, general public opinion, including a lot of the left, was still sort of in the hangover of the positive attitude to Israel. They had to be sort of educated and detoxified. We were then working in an atmosphere where people had been more sympathetic to Israel, but they began to have some doubts, and we helped sort of develop this tendency. Nowadays, you know, I speak at a meeting, somebody comes to me, you know, maybe a person in their 50s, 60s, says, you can't remember me, but I was a student in University of Essex, also Sussex, in the early 70s. You came to a meeting and you spoke, and this changed my mind. And I get this, you know, on a regular basis in many places I go to. So this means that we were able to achieve something.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, when you say you were speaking at meetings, that how many people were at these meetings?
Well, they varied, but I mean, very often, I mean, sometimes, you know, I remember a meeting in the LSE, for example, where we were not the main speaker. The main speaker was an invited, you know, general from Israel, who we demolished. The hall was packed, and we were among the audience. And then he actually wrote later about it, how, you know, how the experience was very sobering for him. He actually became, you know, a bit critical of the Israeli government.
So you were very effective then
at that meeting. In some cases, it, you know, it may be 20 people. In some cases, it could be 200 or 100. I mean, typically, you know, it would be 50 people, let's say, in a meeting. But I mean, each of us went, you know, to three or four meetings a week, up and down the country.
And I wonder if you could maybe talk to us a little bit about Khamsin.
Yes, well, those of us that were based in Europe, especially beginning in Paris, and then it moved to London, those of us who were sort of affiliated to Matzpen, we always thought that the way forward in our part of the world is to have a joint venture with like-minded people from the Arab Palestinian and other Arab people, including also Iranian. And this is what Khamsin was. It was a joint venture by socialists from the Arab East and some of the Arab West, and some Israeli socialists, people, members or connected to Matzpen.
And what was the hope to achieve with Khamsin?
Look, I mean, what is necessary talking about the, you know, the sort of the projecting to the future. I think the problem of Israel-Palestine can only be solved in a regional context, and in my view, in a socialist context. I can go into the analysis why I think this is. The only way, and the problem will not be solved in a benign way short of this. But in order for this to happen, you need to prepare organizationally in a joint organization of, you know, people like us from all the whole region, including Israel, of course, and the surrounding Arab countries. So this was an attempt in that direction. Unfortunately, so far, all attempts in this direction have not succeeded.
So how did Matzpen continue after you left Israel?
Well, it continued for a while, but you know that the radical left has a disease, which is, you know, sectarianism, splitting. I mean, Matzpen, actually, we tried, you know, not to be too narrow. I mean, we allowed people of, I mean, we accepted within Matzpen people of, you know, some of us were sort of had Maoist tendencies, some were Trotskyists, some were, you know, neither the one nor the other, and we managed for a while to keep this. But then, you know, people within Matzpen, mostly influenced by their sort of co-thinkers in other countries, began to sort of engage in splits. There were a series of damaging splits. So by 1973, there were a couple of minor splits in 1970, where one small group of sort of Maoist inclined people split off, and the other one was some kind of Trotskyist sect. But in 1973, the organization must have been split into more or less two parts. And then before that, it was just above the critical mass of, you know, size that was viable for, you know, publishing a magazine and doing political work. Once it sort of split in two parts, each of them became less viable and sort of it lingered on, but Matzpen sort of wound up as an active organization in the 1980s.
However, just as Matzpen was going into decline, a huge anti-war movement was beginning to stir in protest against Israel's 1982 war with Lebanon.
The really big thing was the 82, the Lebanon war.
The first Lebanon war, so-called.
Yeah. Because this was not just big thing for us. It changed the political map in the left, really. Mm. Suddenly, there were organizations which objected the war.
Mm.
For the first time in Israeli history. Yeah.
Of soldiers, ex-soldiers.
And so the first Lebanon war was the first time that the reservists and soldiers and
ex-soldiers, and many other. I mean, basically, there was, for example, in Tel Aviv, there was a huge mass demonstration. Hundreds of thousands. Of this organization which still exists called Peace Now.
This was actually because of the 70s. Shalom Achshav. This actually started after the 73 war, which was the first war when Israel didn't win outright. And suddenly people say, oh, we need a peace. So they are like Labour Party people, more or less. But 100,000, 200,000
people. Yeah, yeah, there were mass demonstrations. Yeah.
Demonstrating for peace, for some kind of political solution.
That must have made a huge difference, think if you're used to being a tiny group.
They didn't impact on us very much because they are so much more right and they are in the center of Zionism. But the objection to the Lebanon war, they said their name was Yesh Gvul.
But in Hebrew, you know, it's a play of words because it means Yesh Gvul can mean either there is a border and there is a limit.
Some of them were much more leftish and much more radical in the message.
Yeah.
And it was a big change for us because there was no point of us continuing like 20, 30 people demonstrating here and there and selling there, but we joined them.
Was there like an organized backlash, for instance, from, I don't know, maybe far-right Israelis or from the state?
In demonstrations, the army chased us sometime in Ramallah once. It was a big, and we were arrested for a few days. And
What happened in Ramallah?
We had a big demonstration in Ramallah.
Mm.
The army just chased us. We ran through the gardens of the back garden. It was really quite a few people, not just from Matzpen. There was people from, like I said, we were already working together with other organizations. And they caught us and put us in detention for a few days.
At the time, there was a big difference to how you were treated if you were Jewish or Palestinian doing the same the same activity. Obviously, they were much harsher on Palestinians. And the General Security Service, Shabak, which is like their equivalent of MI5, if you like, would go down very heavily on Palestinians rather than on Jews. Because at the time, and I said it has changed because I think now Israel is much more polarized society than used to be. At the time, the powers that be wanted to maintain sort of Jewish solidarity, if you like. And because it was a very small country, then everybody was somebody's son or brother or nephew or whatever. And some of these people were actually themselves sort of high-ranking people, perhaps, or certainly part of the Zionist establishment. So you wouldn't want to antagonize people too much. So apart from the only harassment, which I already kind of living in the UK at that time, which is why I missed those huge demonstrations, you know, the first Lebanon war. I was already living here, in London. However, I was sort of regularly on the line between Israel and London. And every time you get in and out, you are stopped, you know, where you get to the passport control and you realize who you are. And then you ask to wait a moment, and then the policeman would come and they'll accompany you to the MI5 quarters in the airport. And then you have the agents who start, for one thing, in those days, obviously, it was pre-digital days. So any bit of paper you had, they'd sort of, you know, they'd search you, sometimes strip search you. They'll take away any piece of paper with any scribble or whatever and take it away, photocopy it, yeah? So that was kind of without failing for a good number of years. In fact, until the Oslo Accords or the, I think, you know, 92 or 93 or whatever, that continued. Then it stopped, yeah? Maybe we were not considered so dangerous anymore. But until then, yeah, I mean, to me, it happened regularly. And obviously, you knew that you're not supposed to take on your known names or addresses or anything that could implicate or, you know, sort of give trouble to other people. Yeah. So that was the main sort of state harassment.
I lost 3 jobs because of Mats Pain.
So yeah. Can you go into that?
Yeah. I worked in the port of Haifa in 75, just through arguments in the, you know, discussion, not argument, you know, even talking about politics, because in Israel you could talk about politics a lot. And people found out that what I believe, and suddenly I was invited and said, sorry, you cannot continue here. And that's it. That was the first. And the second was in the Cinematheque. In the cinema, you had to carry, they decided you have to carry a gun. And, I was a steward. I was the usher. They were worried about terror and stuff. And I was not allowed. I was prohibited from, so they say, sorry, you cannot continue here. After
you weren't allowed to carry a gun?
No. And the third place was in a school, but this was late 80s. I was a teacher in Tel Aviv. And yeah, after 3 years, there was big argument, big discussion about conscription. And somebody, a big famous author, to speak about it.
Some author who wrote some sort of very kind of nationalistic children's literature, about, you know, series about a gang of, you know, a bit like the Secret Seven or Famous Five, right. but in a Zionist context, yeah?
Yeah,
I mean, fighting all the enemies.
Anyway, there was a big discussion for the sixth form, and I said, I think you don't have to conscript. You can say no, there is a choice, always choice, and if you don't believe that you should, the occupation should continue, you can say no. Because he said it's absolute duty. It's like there is no dispute about the fact that every Israeli has to join the army. And I said, no, it's not true. And do you think German soldiers should conscript to the Wehrmacht at the time? What do you think about it? And that's it. That's the end. That was my end after 3 years. They told me I cannot continue there.
And so, I mean, I'm sure I sort of know the answer to this, but in those scenarios, were the unions any of the places that you worked, helpful?
I didn't know about unions in the port of Haifa, although they probably did have a union there, but I was only 19, 20 years old then, and kind of naive about stuff. And the Cinematheque didn't have a union, it was the only start, you know, we were the union.
Yeah.
The union didn't support me in the school, I went to the union. Not just about this, I said, and they said, no.
But I think maybe, in brackets, one should clarify one issue.
What's
about
a union?
A unions in Israel, still now there, but certainly in those days. You see, everything in Israel was created from scratch by the Zionists, even before 48, before Israel was established. Now, there was a mega organization, a bit equivalent to the TUC, but not quite.
The Histadrut,
which was itself part of the, you know, from the very beginning, they were established in the 1920s or thereabout, a part of the Zionist project. But not only that, at the time, the Histadrut were not only a trade union, they were actually one of the largest employers. And I don't mean trade union officials. They had actually, the Israeli economy, until perhaps the 80s, was roughly divided into 3 sectors. 1/3 private capital, 1/3 so-called state industries and so on, And the other third was Histadrut industry. They had factories, they had industry. There were wearings of two hats. There were the employers and the trade union, both at the same time.
Do you feel that Mats Ben made any lasting impact on Israeli society?
I'm sure that it has, because after many years, you know, people still, from time to time, people mention Mats Ben. Mats Ben has made a hugely disproportionate impact on, let us say, the psyche, the political psyche of Israel. You find novels written nowadays, and the, you know, sort of Mats Ben is mentioned. From time to time, they mention the statement that I mentioned before. It comes up, Mats Ben, because, you know, the analysis that we made then and the views that we put forward are, as it were, still topical.
What are your thoughts about the direction that Israeli society is going in now?
For a number of years, I've been very worried about the prospects for the foreseeable future. I mean, the short and medium term. In the long term, we can talk about, in the long term, we're all dead. I have a growing feeling, which is supported by growing amount of evidence, that what is in danger of being perpetrated is another massive ethnic cleansing. I mean, to put it very briefly, first of all, to think logically, Israel has done everything to prevent the so-called two-state solution. It never actually subscribed to allowing a proper, you know, sovereign Palestinian state. People think that the Oslo Accords of 1990 don't mention a Palestinian state. Israel never subscribed to it, and in fact has done everything possible to subvert it, to torpedo any possibility of Palestinians. So two-state solution is off. One state with a possible Palestinian majority. And at the moment, the numerical ratio between Hebrew Israelis and Palestinian Arabs in the whole area ruled by Israel is about equal. They are about equals. The demographic trend indicates a Palestinian Arab majority under Israeli rule. Continuing the present situation is unstable. It's not sustainable. They certainly don't want a single state with a Palestinian Arab majority, or even a minority close to one half, you know. So what is the alternative? They certainly, I mean, there is a growing pressure. Colonization goes on. They want to annex, you know, bit after bit. But, you know, eventually they will have to resolve it, and I think they are planning to resolve it by massive ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the West Bank. I mean, in Gaza, they are actually strangling it to such an extent, they're poisoning the place, really. I mean, water is undrinkable, pollution is incredible. I mean, there is near starvation.
In general, maybe public, general public discourse, I think maybe definitely there's a feeling of like, well, Israel's not entirely at fault, but also not entirely innocent.
Yeah, of course, the established media are still, you know, very much, you know, in that line. But let's talk about these sort of vaguely progressive people. What I feel, and I think it's corroborated by various, you know, public opinion polls and so on, there is a shift in public opinion. There is a lot more, let us say, critical attitude to Israel now than was at that time, you know, 50 years ago. That's definitely true. So the Zionists and the Israeli Hasbara, the propaganda machine, is really desperate for weapons to counter this. It is especially true, and this is proved by various, you know, bits of research and polls, that there is this process of disenchantment with Israel among young people, students, and including Jewish young people. And they find this very worrying. A measure of this is the BDS movement. The BDS movement is causing them a lot of headache because it is gaining support. It is, you can't say that it is hurting Israel economically, but in terms of its profile, its standing in public opinion, especially among students, among younger people. Look, I mean, this young Palestinian girl, a soldier comes to her home, stands in the front yard of her home. She slaps him and spits in his face. She's become a heroic figure. She actually, in the circumstances, especially in the circumstances of a military dictatorship, is a mild protest. A soldier came. She didn't go to him. He came to her front yard, and she said, "Go away." He didn't go away. She slapped him, and you young kid.
And I think also there was, you know, something, her cousin had recently also been shot by...
He's arrested, you know, the last...
Oh, really?
Yesterday they arrested him. He's a 15-year-old. He's got half his face missing. Mm. You know, he's got part of his skull, you know, still needs to be fitted back because they had to remove part of the skull in order to treat his brain. He was, you know, touch and go. I mean... It's a sort of medical miracle that he survived. And this guy with half a face, he's a kid of 15 years.
When you were in Matzben in Israel at the time, there were a few dozen of you. How do you feel the anti-Zionist left in Israel is now?
It's in very poor state. The anti-Zionist left, first of all, it's very small. But we were small in 1968. But it is fragmented in the sense that there is no single organization with a program of any size. Maybe that, you know, group of five people, you know. But we had a sort of outlook, a program. We were not a single issue group. Matzben was, you know, if you like, a mini party or a political organization with its own view on world events, on socialism, and including on the issues of immediate concern, you know, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and so on. Matzben was not even created in order specifically to deal with the local issue. It came into being as a socialist organization with views on world political issues. There is no such group on the radical anti-Zionist left in Israel. It is, you know, there are groups that function on single issues. They do marvelous work as you know, anarchists against the wall, Ta'ayush, you know, nominated mainly by people with the sort of Communist Party affiliation, and various other groups who do work on single issues of local, but there is no political organization that has even an idea of organizing the Israeli working class.
I wonder if you could explain why you think it's important as part of the anti-Zionist struggle to also, you know, build within...
How long have you got? I mean, you want to start now? I'll be very brief. Look, in the end, we always believed, you know, since the beginning of Matzben, that the only social force that can overthrow the Zionist regime in Israel is the Israeli working class. If you take a contrary example of South Africa, apartheid was overthrown, right? Apartheid was overthrown by class struggle inside, okay? But the difference was that the working class that overthrew the apartheid regime was part of the oppressed population. They had an interest of, you know, to get rid of apartheid, even if it wasn't actually accompanied by a socialist transformation. What have you got in the case of Israel? The colonization of Palestine by Zionism was a completely different model. The indigenous population, as opposed to South Africa, was not exploited but excluded. Neither the surrounding Arab states nor the majority of the Palestinian people are capable of overthrowing the existing regime. It is only the Israeli working class itself that can do it. It is the only, if you look around, what other forces are able to do it? I don't think there are. But why should it do it? If not, to achieve one democratic state with equal rights for everyone under a capitalist regime, what would it gain from this? It would still be an exploited class, but it would lose its national privileges as part of a privileged nation, you know, dominant nation. Israeli working class has no interest in what is put forward as the one-state solution, which is, you know, the plan proposed by some well-meaning people, and it, you know, it would be lovely if it could be implemented, but who is going to do it? You need to overthrow the Israeli regime. Why should the majority of the Israeli people, the working class, and, you know, the sort of its natural allies, why should they do it? It wouldn't improve their situation as a class, as an exploited class, because, you know, it would be a capitalist state. The only prospect for overthrowing, for a benign resolution of the conflict, is if there was a socialist transformation regionally and the Israeli working class could join it, as sort of was visible as a potentiality in 2011, when there was an enormous sympathy to the Egyptian working class, which is the major working class in the area, by the way, huge, giant. If the Israeli working class were to join, then it would swap its position as an exploited class, but part of a dominant nation, for a part of a dominant class now, but without special national privilege. This is a swap that has some logic to it.
And I suppose, yeah, when you say there were those glimmers in 2011, you know, because not only was the Arab Spring happening, but it felt like also in Israel there was
huge,
also the
huge. It was the biggest demonstrations ever in the history of Israel.
And I remember watching a video of this one woman demonstrating, and I remember her saying, "Security, security! All they give us is security, and we can't." You know, we can't live with security anymore. And
well, the slogans I liked best is, "The market is free, we are slaves." But, I mean, there was enormous sympathy with the Egyptian working class. This indicates a possibility in a regional context where the Israeli Hebrew workers would actually join forces. But for this, you need a long political preparation. It's not just you know, going to be like this. I believe that in the end, the only force capable of overthrowing the Zionist regime of Israel is the Israeli working class itself. Who else? Beruft uns schulde Waffen, in Schlacht uns Bieren ist
Greg. Die Welt von Gewalt hat nun leid. That's it for part two. We'd like to thank Moshe, Haim and Udi for speaking with us. Thanks to Louise Barry for editing both of these episodes, and special thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Our Patreon supporters give regular donations which enable us to make this podcast and run the Working Class History Project. You can support us as well at patreon.com/workingclasshistory, where you get early access to episodes and other benefits. The more support we get, the more time it means we can devote to this project, make more frequent episodes, make them better quality, and do more original research and get our history out to more people. So thanks again for your really generous support. We really appreciate it. Catch you next time.